WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have been thoroughly enjoying an engrossing and fascinating book called Veritas, A Harvard Professor, A Con Man, and the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. The book is an extraordinary exploration of a really extraordinary story involving a highly regarded professor of theology, or maybe might be better to say once a highly regarded theology professor by the name of Dr. Karen King, who was the Hollis Professor of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School, and someone who essentially announced to the world a sensational announcement, the existence of a fragment of something which she called the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, an ancient papyrus text which seemed to indicate that Jesus was married. And if this was true, this is something that would radically and dramatically alter the way in which we think of the Christian faith and the Christian church's attitudes about women over the years. Ultimately, this proved to be a forgery, a fake, this fragment of papyrus. And the story of how this learned scholar and theologian could be duped is the subject of this fascinating book by investigative reporter and journalist Ariel Sabar. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, previously the author of My Father's Paradise, A Son's Search for His Jewish Past in Kurdish Iraq, and this latest book, which is published by Doubleday, is again titled Veritas, A Harvard Professor, A Con Man, and the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. Ariel Sabar, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I just can't tell you how much I admire the work that you did on this book. And in the final notes in the book, you kind of outline the extent of your work in travel alone. This gives us a sense of the scope of this story and of the immense amount of work it represented to follow this story so thoroughly. Just give our listeners even a summary of just what was involved in following this story and telling it in this detailed fashion.
Yeah, well, yeah, thanks. I mean, it really was one of those stories where every time you sort of thought you'd reached the end of the road and you thought you had reported everything you needed to report, some other door opened, usually a trap door, that you would fall through and discover this whole sort of new area of research or discovery that you just did not know was there in the beginning. So yeah, the reporting, you know, took me to something like 12 American states and maybe a half dozen European countries. It was kind of this sprawling cast of characters who were involved either in perpetuating this fraud or in helping me paint the picture of the totally fascinating and totally different sort of central characters in this detective story. One, of course, is this, you know, profoundly respected Harvard professor, Karen King, who is the holder of, like, the oldest endowed professorial chair in all of North America, And then on the other hand, you have the individual man named Walter Fritz, who emerges as the con artist figure, who, you know, was a never finished college. He's a motorcycle riding pornographer. He has had other brushes. He's sort of reincarnated himself in different guises across the world. Really fascinating, complex figure, and you know, both of whom were actually, you know, in many ways kind of secretive. And so it took traveling to all those places. It took knocking on a lot of doors, making a lot of phone calls, you know, working with people who spoke different languages who could help me, you know, translators, fixers, to be able to kind of get to the bottom of this really wild story.
Explain your connection to it, that is, to the story itself, and the reason why you were, in a sense, covering this story almost from the beginning and intersecting it. I mean, being on hand personally for a couple of incredibly significant moments in this long story arc.
Yeah, that's what made it so interesting. It's, you know, you typically, a reporter will enter a story like this after there's been some kind of big controversy or scandal, and that wasn't the case for me. I was a relatively new freelancer for Smithsonian Magazine. You know, that's the sort of famous magazine associated with the Smithsonian institutions here in Washington, D.C., where I live. And they had gotten a tip that this Harvard professor was about to announce this major discovery. This was back in the fall of 2012. And that the professor would be willing to meet with me and I think a couple of other journalists ahead of time, just a very select group of people, to sort of show them the papyrus, tell them what she was about to announce ahead of the big announcement, which she was going to make in Rome, actually, across the street from the Vatican. So sort of a lot of symbolism in making that announcement there. And, you know, I was sort of stunned because, again, I was a relatively new freelancer for a big magazine. I'd been a daily journalist for a long time, but it seemed like a big story. And the editor said, how would you like to travel to Harvard, interview this professor who's about to make this major announcement, and then follow her to Rome, where she'll actually announce the discovery of what she's calling the gospel of Jesus' wife to, you know, the most accomplished scholars in her field at a conference room across from the Vatican. And it was just sort of like, it just seemed so just incredible at the outset. And it seemed like if it were true, it would be a big story because it would have all these implications certainly for the Roman Catholic Church and, you know, views about women and sexuality within the Christian tradition. And so it seemed like a sort of meaty story. And, you know, it turned out, you know, I turned out to be the only journalist in the room in Rome when Karen King made this announcement to scholars. So it did really give me kind of a window seat to this saga even before everything started to unravel.
Dr. Karen King was, in your words, a dazzling interpreter of condemned scripture. And in another point in that same passage, you refer to such texts as banished gospels, the suppressed writings of ancient believers. Describe to our listeners what we are talking about here and what makes this field of study especially interesting and also fraught with some real challenges.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people, you know, if they're believers, you know, if they go to church and they pick up the Bible and then back in the pews, they open it up and inside is, you know, the New Testament. You know, and depending on your tradition, there may be a few extra books, a few fewer books. But it's basically the sort of officially authorized collection of sacred scriptures from early Christianity that ancient bishops decided were the ones that right-thinking Christians should read to practice their faith. Now, the New Testament does not include the many texts that were in fact circulating in early Christianity. So there are a lot of other texts that are out there. Sometimes they're called apocrypha or apocryphal texts. Sometimes they're called extra-canonical texts, meaning they're outside the Christian canon. And sometimes they're called Gnostic texts. There are a lot of different names, and they're disputed sort of what the best names to use to describe them are. But basically what it tells us is that in early Christianity, there wasn't this sort of unified set of beliefs that everyone kind of bought into. Everyone agreed to the what Jesus' life and teachings meant. In fact, there was quite a vociferous and voluble debate among different groups of Christians about exactly who Jesus was, what his life meant, what his crucifixion meant. And it was only later that the New Testament, the sort of official collection of texts that became the New Testament, were sort of put together. So Karen King's specialty were these texts that did not make the New Testament, that sort of didn't make the cut, that wound up on the cutting room floor, if you will. And so they're absolutely fascinating because they give you a different view of how some groups of early Christians perceived Jesus. And you get a different set. There are many of the same characters. You know, we often have the disciples. We often have, the Virgin Mary. We often have Mary Magdalene. But their roles are different in some sense, and their view of the world is different. One of the big differences in the kinds of texts that Karen King studied, these so-called Gnostic texts, was that they often gave female figures more prominence. Eve is a much more important figure, for instance, in these texts. Mary Magdalene is a much more important figure. She's one of Jesus' closest disciples. There's a female divinity, sort of the counterpart to God, if you will, named Sophia, who is very prominent. And so King was very drawn to these texts. And what makes them difficult to study and what makes them fraught is that most of them only survive in fragmentary form. They were ancient, and the medieval monks did not sort of copy them often enough for them to survive into modern editions. All we have are these sort of fragmentary texts that were often exist in the form of papyrus scraps that were pulled from the deserts of Egypt sometime between the 1800s and the present. Mm. And so there's a lot of kind of filling in the gaps that scholars have to do to try to figure out exactly what these extra canonical or apocryphal texts say and mean.
Right. And as you describe these fragments, which you say sometimes look like continents on a globe. I mean, that with, you know, the oceans are that what is missing. And you write this: scholars needed to draw on deep wells of learning to propose restorations of missing text. The itch to get creative, not just by filling gaps, but by correcting the surrounding texts in ways that make the manuscript more exciting, can be strong. You're pointing to an uncomfortable reality here. Well, first of all, that those who study these things, even with the best of intentions, are human beings, and that there are temptations wrapped up in this kind of work. Tell us more about this itch to get creative, which is so tempting.
That's a great question. And I think it's something that any human being would confront in the same situation. All of us come to a text or even a situation with a particular set of beliefs or things that we believe to be true, or that in some cases, and I think more relevant here, that we want to be true even though we don't have evidence for them. And so what these sort of fill-in-the-blank papyri allow scholars to do, if they're not careful, is take the breaks, take what are called, the fancy word is lacunae, which means like a gap in the text where either like a worm has eaten through a few words, or, you know, the papyrus itself is just broken away and we don't know what is there. I think of it, I don't know if you remember the game Mad Libs, from when I was a kid, where, you know, there are blanks and then someone is asked to fill in the word that they think most belongs. I mean, in that case, the end result is humor, but the idea here for scholars is to put in a word that they think most likely fits and completes the meaning that some ancient author who we have no idea who they were probably meant. And so there's a bit of, you know, there's a lot of scholarship, there's a lot of learning that goes into figuring out what might be said, but there's also guesswork, and there's also perhaps sometimes some wishful thinking. And so that's where scholars can sometimes get in trouble, and that's where often scholars will have, you know, very dynamic debates over precisely what word was supposed to go in that place where we don't have a word anymore. Hmm.
We're speaking with Ariel Sabar about his book Veritas, a Harvard professor, a con man, and the gospel of Jesus's wife. Your book is a methodical examination of this whole story from the very beginning. I mean, when Dr. Karen King first heard from this mysterious figure in your book, he is unnamed for quite some time. Eventually, we learn his name as Walter Fritz. And your book also takes us into that those early steps when Dr. King was trying to figure out whether or not this fragment from the so-called Gospel of Jesus' Wife might indeed be authentic. One of the most interesting passages in the book is when you sort of take us inside the thought process of a couple of the experts whose opinion she sought out, and about the kind of logic with which they examined this fragment, logic which you call sound but serpentine. Because of and this particularly revolved around the matter of some of the handwriting looking rather awkward. And the thought process by which they analyzed this and tried to make determinations is in and of itself fascinating, I think. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, before Karen King went public with this papyrus fragment, she took it to one of the most acclaimed papyrologists, that's a scholar who studies papyrus, in the world, a gentleman named Roger Bagnall, who was a professor at Columbia before he took over the directorship of the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World in Manhattan. It's a NYU, New York University institution. And so one of Karen King's former students brought it to this sort of informal seminar that Roger Bagnall hosts in his Upper West Side apartment every month with papyrologists in the New York area. And they all kind of looked at this thing and said, God, this is really ugly. Like the handwriting seems weird. We've never seen anything like it before. The letters are formed in these bizarre shapes. The ink doesn't look quite right. Something just seems really, really off about it. And so their first inclination, which turned out to be the right one, was that this is a forgery. I mean, it's just so bad. There's so many errors in it. And then something weird happened sort of midway through their meeting, which is where someone says, well, God, you know, if this were really a forgery, wouldn't the forger have done a much better job? So it's like, it's so bad that wouldn't, I mean, doesn't the fact that it's so bad mean that it might be actually authentic? Because a good forger would make it look like a really authentic ancient piece, and this looks nothing like that. Therefore, it must be authentic. And so when I say it's serpentine, it sort of took an evidence that led them in one direction very plainly, and then they sort of tried to read that evidence in a counterintuitive, counterfactual way, which led them in the end to tell Karen King, yeah, you know, this looks like it could be authentic. And that was one of the sort of green lights she took to go forward with announcing this discovery.
One of the really intriguing parallel stories here is of Dan Brown's blockbuster bestseller, The Da Vinci Code, in which a fictional Harvard professor discovers a centuries-old Catholic plot to conceal evidence that Jesus was married and Jesus had a daughter with Mary Magdalene. I mean, explosive information. And the cover-up itself also kind of an explosive discovery. You describe Professor King's sort of attitude towards this book, both privately and publicly, I suppose, as in a sense kind of awkward and a little bit shifting. I mean, distancing, yet embracing. A really, really fascinating aspect of this story, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, of course, you know, probably one of the best-selling books of all time, something like 80 million copies. Multiple translations, but the important thing I think in the context of my book is that, you know, that book is very clearly a work of fiction. It doesn't advertise itself as anything other than a fictional novel, thriller, and it did very well. What was interesting is that during the Da Vinci Code craze in sort of the mid-aughts, early 2000s, Karen King became one of the go-to scholars that reporters would turn to, journalists, radio interviewers, TV interviewers would turn to figure out like the real story. Okay, this is what Dan Brown said happened. How much of this might actually be true? And Karen King was actually among the least critical of the, you know, sort of famous scholars who were interviewed for various TV specials around the Da Vinci Code, saying, you know, basically saying, yes, it's a work of fiction, but it forces us to ask some really important questions about early Christianity that people should have been asking long before. Like, she, it didn't really bother her that it was a work of fiction. What was important to her was that it was forcing ordinary readers, you know, believers, non-believers, to begin to ask the kinds of questions about early Christianity and the kind of diversity of early Christianity that she had spent her scholarly career trying to get people to care about. And so it was this really interesting position, because you had other scholars, even people at Yale, saying, come on, this thing, the Dan Brown book, it's a complete invention. I mean, yes, he has some references to some of these extra-canonical texts, and yes, there might be a quote here and there from them, but everything else is just, you know, it's a brilliant story, but it just doesn't happen to be true. And I think Dr. King was more open to the idea that, well, it may not be sort of historically true, but it's asking some worthwhile historical questions. And so, and then one of the things you have to, of course, remember about the book is that it features a fictional Harvard professor of religion who discovers the secret of Jesus's, the long-suppressed secret of Jesus's alleged marriage to Mary Magdalene, child of Magdalene, in part thanks to a cryptic text on a small piece of papyrus. And I'm like, you know, this, of course, sounds a lot like Karen King. It sounds very much like the situation Karen King finds herself in, you know, 7 years, 8 years after the Da Vinci Code is published. So the parallel between the Harvard professor discovering a Mary Jesus thanks to a piece of papyrus, there's a kind of duplication where you have it in the fictional Da Vinci Code in 2003, and then in the true story of Karen King going public with a papyrus about a Mary Jesus, less than a decade later. And that became a really fascinating strand of the story. I don't want to give away too much there, but it certainly does appear to be a case of kind of life imitating art in a completely unexpected way.
Absolutely. I appreciate the fact, and I have seen this said in more than one review of your book, that your treatment of Dr. Karen King herself is unstintingly honest and frank, yet compassionate. I've seen the word compassionate used in two different reviews. I mean, someone else could have written this book about this. I mean, about this high-flying theological professor being duped, could have written it in a way that would have been unkind and in a sense much more sensationalistic. Can you just talk for a moment about the way in which you treat Dr. King in your book, and if the way this book is being characterized, as I just quoted these reviews, if you think that's a fair summation of how you talk about her?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's true of all the journalism I do. I really don't think you do readers a service by portraying anybody as sort of black or white. I mean, all of us are human. All of us have our strengths, our weaknesses. And I really wanted to portray Karen King and in fact, the sort of con man figure as profoundly human, you know, flawed, as all of us are, but profoundly human and making human choices in situations of extreme pressure. And how do they react? What does that reveal about their character, about their motivations? And I think what makes and so I always, even though I had a lot of cooperation from Karen King while writing my Smithsonian magazine story way back in 2012, you know, once it became clear that, you know, this was a forgery, she sort of stopped talking to the press. And so that made me actually sort of bend over double and try to track down as many people as possible who were close to Karen King at various points in her life, who knew, who understand her thinking process, who, you know, had social relationships with her, family relationships, to try to really portray her as a three-dimensional human being rather than some sort of stereotype. And so I do hope people become engaged with her as a character, because I think at the end, I think one of the things I hope people take away is that this is a tragedy. This is someone who actually believed she was doing the right thing, even though in her own gut she knew this was a fake. From the very start, she believed this was probably a forgery, but she pressed ahead anyway. and sort of cut corners and withheld evidence and, you know, blocked efforts by journalists and other scholars to learn the truth, because she felt that it would be better for the world if there were such a text. There was a text that portrayed Jesus in a loving relationship with a woman, and with it, not only not any woman, but Mary Magdalene, not the sort of, you know, repentant prostitute, the false portrayal that has been out there for many, many years, that is in fact false, it is truly false, but a woman who was a leader, early Christian leader, who Jesus found compelling enough to not only to marry, but to defend as being a disciple, as worthy of discipleship as any of the men, because this would fundamentally change the way in which many modern Christians could engage with their faith in a more egalitarian way. So it kind of comes from a good place, and I think it raises the question of, you know, can one use a lie to advance a larger truth? And I don't have the answer to that. I don't necessarily propose one. But I think it's one of the questions I hope readers leave with is, if can sort of dishonest means justify noble ends? And, you know, I think people will come to different conclusions about that. But I hope that people see that what was motivating Karen King was something that she believed was noble and righteous. And so that's what I think makes it a complex story, and I hopefully leads to what some of the reviewers have called this, the parts of it, sort of compassionate portrayal.
Ariel Sabar is author of Veritas, a Harvard professor, a con man, and the gospel of Jesus' wife, published by Doubleday. And I should mention that the book includes fascinating photographs, including photographs of this supposed fragment from the gospel of Jesus' wife. Ariel Sabar, thank you so much for giving the world this fascinating book and for talking about it today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg.
And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I'm really pleased and honored to be reconnecting with John Cunningham, who is Chief Executive of the National AIDS Memorial. I spoke with Mr. Cunningham first for the June 29th Morning Show, in which at the very end of June, Pride Month, I reran an interview that I recorded quite a number of years before with Cleve Jones, who conceived the idea of the AIDS Memorial Quilt. And we got from John Cunningham kind of an update on where the memorial quilt is now housed and a bit more about its history. I asked John Cunningham if we could have a follow-up conversation to talk further about the National AIDS Memorial and the work that they do beyond the quilt itself. And we do this in part because of an anniversary, an unhappy anniversary. June of 2021 marked 40 years since the first cases of AIDS were reported in the United States. And so we will find out from Mr. Cunningham a little more about the work of the National AIDS Memorial and about the work that remains to be done to help more and more of the global public understand this disease. John Cunningham, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be back with you.
I wasn't going to ask you this. I'm going to ask it, and if you don't feel like answering, that's okay. But I'm really curious to know what is it like to be a gay man in the United States of America in 2021 versus what it was like for you whenever it was that you, in a sense, came out? I think sometimes for younger people who are gay or queer in any respect, they do not understand how radically the world has changed in a relatively short amount of time, although for those living through those years, I'm sure it didn't seem like a short period of time for so much to open up. But I just wonder if you could give our listeners some sense of, from your own very personal experience, how dramatically different it is to live in the world now versus when you first came out.
Well, I'll start off by saying I was blessed to be born into a family that was incredibly loving and compassionate, loved me for who I was, and always supported me and nurtured me, no matter how difficult it was at that time. And I remember my father, when I came out, telling me, you know, I will always support you and I always love you, and I respect where you're at, but you need to realize that the journey that this is going to take you on is going to have bumpy roads, and it will not always be easy, but it will build character. You know, I mean, I just turned 61. I came out in my 20s, and it was a very different time. It was a very different time. I've always been pretty open and out. I was blessed also to live in San Francisco, but you know, the fact of the matter is, and I can remember back, and I was at a Pride event that we recently at San Francisco International Airport, where the quilt was on display and they had the opening, and I can remember where it was called Gay Freedom Day or Gay Liberation Day. And so it was indeed a time when we were fighting for our rights. We were fighting not to be accepted, but to be equal, that we didn't want anything extra. We didn't want anything more, but we didn't want to be discriminated against. And, you know, we have made it a long way, but I think it's very, very important that right now that all of your listeners realize that there is a struggle going on. There are right now over 250 bills in state legislatures that are focused on against LGBT, and they are using the trans community as the wedge. And, you know, again, it's a situation, you know, where the trans, an individual that is navigating through that difficult to, process to get themselves to a place of acceptance, we need to stand with them. We need to stand up with them for their rights and for their equality, and not let the backlash that's happening on the right really take them down, because we're losing our rights. We are losing a lot. We could lose marriage equality. The Supreme Court has been changed. And there's some real fanaticism going on out there in state legislatures, whether it be voting rights or whether it be LGBT. I'm fearful of where we are and where we're going.
So in other words, it is not a case of the door shut on darker and scarier days, that in fact there remains much work to be done for anybody who cares about this, whether they're gay or a straight ally or whoever they may be.
Well, it all comes back to, as I said in the interview we had the other day, a recent interview, it comes down to otherism. You know, if you can paint somebody as other and different than you, then it's a lot easier for you to devalue them and to discriminate against them and to marginalize them. But when you start looking at them as another human being, and that's how the gay rights movement, it's you take down prejudice and discrimination one relationship at a time, you know, by changing hearts and minds of a neighbor because they see you. I knew you growing up, and I now see you as a gay or a lesbian or a trans individual, and it changes that heart and that mind.
We're speaking with John Cunningham, Chief Executive of the National AIDS Memorial. As we talked in our previous interview that aired on June 29th, the National AIDS Memorial houses the famous quilt, but there is, of course, much more to the National AIDS Memorial than that. Tell us about the scope of your activities and particularly what is of most urgent importance at the moment.
So this year marks the 30th anniversary since the founding of the AIDS Memorial Grove in Golden Gate Park. The memorial is a 10 plus acre healing garden, won numerous landscape architecture awards. You can visit AIDSmemorial.org and see some of the beautiful photos. Our mission is that by sharing the story of the struggle against HIV and AIDS, we remember in perpetuity the lives lost. We offer healing and hope to survivors, and we inspire new generations of activists in the fight against stigma, denial, and hate for a just future. And I can't think of anything that's more important right now. There is hate out there. There is stigma. There is injustice. And, you know, I think that we can use the AIDS crisis as a way to inform and inspire young people, but also to open up the hearts and minds that these divisive ways are not the way for a society to continue to grow and to expand. And the AIDS Memorial has a couple of different programs. You know, a memorial is more than the engraved names in stone. It is the stories of those lives. And so, and in this case, and it's the story of an epidemic and a pandemic that befell a nation, a world. We have had over 750,000 Americans that have died. But it also is the story of those individual lives, and it is the story of communities that have risen up. And so we have a program called the Storytelling Surviving Voices Project that we've documented the history of the AIDS crisis as it relates to women, the Asian Pacific Islander community, the hemophilia community, which were devastated. Over half of the hemophiliacs in America died in a short 10-year period because of a tainted blood supply, when a government knew that it was. The recovery community, the Black community, trans community. So that's one of our programs that we go out and we capture these stories that forever they'll tell, forever they'll speak, forever they'll give voice. We also want to continue to engage and support, because it, just as Cleve has shared with you, and as I shared that the quilt is an activist teaching tool, the key is to continue to inspire and to inform future generations and young people. So some of your listeners may remember the name Pedro Zamora. Well, Pedro Zamora was on The Real World, season 2. He was a Latinx, HIV positive, gay man from South Florida in his 20s. And he became the face of the epidemic to America. He was on everybody's TV. He passed two days following the airing of the last episode of season 2. And we were blessed to be given the rights for the Pedro Zamora Young Leader Scholarship. So we scholarship tens of thousands of dollars to young people doing social activist, HIV AIDS prevention, public health work, social justice work each year. Through that program. And then we have a massive World AIDS Day program that last year we went online virtual, and we had the blessing of having Cleve with us, and Alicia Garza, who founded Black Lives Matter, and Christian Uquiza, who founded a program called Marked by COVID. We had Anthony Fauci, and this year we'll do it again, and we'll have a conversation with America about the impact of HIV and AIDS on the Black community. But the memorial was created in a derelict abandoned site 30 years ago, a community coming together, and as I say, finding the healing and the power and the strength on either side of the shovel. And so we have a program called the Community Volunteer Workdays, where over 250,000 volunteer hours have been dedicated. We're kicking off again in this next month in July, getting people together. About 125 people come and work together. We serve lunch. We spend time together. We tell stories. We share stories. And it's cross-generational. It's cross-cultural. It's cross-racial. And so it's a really, really powerful way of bringing people together. So our obligation is to continue to be a community builder, to share the stories, and to ensure that those individuals that lives were lost were not lost in vain, that we will never allow a community to be so devastated because of stigma and discrimination and denial and marginalization and by a government that chose not to respond.
I'm blanking on the title, but I interviewed an AIDS activist and a gay rights activist who wrote a really interesting book, a memoir about his decades of work on the cause. And by the end of the interview, I hope I will have thought of the title. But one of the points that he made in the book and that we talked about in the interview was the fact that he, as an older gay man, really wished that the younger generation of gays was more aware of the history.
Yep.
Was more aware of the hard work, the brutally difficult work that was done decades before. And I think, if I remember correctly, he mostly attributed it to just kind of, in general, young people often don't care about history quite as much as we who are older might want them to. But I wonder if that has been your experience as well, that that those who are gay in a world that is at least a bit more open, not that we should be lackadaisical about the freedoms enjoyed today, but that it would be nice if they had more of an awareness of the path that took them to where they are now. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, you know, there is such a debt that is owed to those that have gone before us and that risked so much, because I think it's also just important that our listeners remember that back in the day, if you were discovered as being gay, if you were in a bar and hauled out, or if you were, you know, discovered to have been engaged in some sort of a gay relationship, you would lose your employment. You would sometimes lose your housing. You know, and to some degree, the same held true for HIV and AIDS. If you were discovered that you, or suspected even that you had this mystery illness, you would oftentimes lose your housing and your job. So I think it's so important that young people today take the time to listen, to ask the questions, to find an elder. I mean, that's part of what I think we've lost is some of the storytelling of human to human, person to person, because that's where the power is. You know, what was it like then? What's it like now? And how did we get here? You know, there's a bar in the Castro here in San Francisco. It's called Twin Peaks. It was the first bar to have clear windows. Because, of course, you couldn't have clear windows because people would see you. They would tell your employer and you'd lose your job. You know, so I also think that it's important that, you know, as many have said, that the gay rights movement is one of the movements that it got their have received their rights or moved so rapidly. And I think this is also what we want to look at as to how we can share those best practices to help others that are fighting for their own justice. We owe so much. And I think it's important that young people do take the time, do learn. History, you know, as is said so often, you know, if we do not learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it.
Right. You mentioned earlier that the trans community is being, in a sense, used as a wedge to by some to advance certain agendas that, among other things, could lead to the pulling back of hard-fought rights for the gay community. What do you think is the pathway, in a sense, beyond that or over that for those who do not want to see that happen? What do you think is the key to undermining those efforts?
You know, as an old timer, you know, I yearn to see, you know, people in the streets protesting, asking, demanding for rights. You know, the gay rights movement owes so much also to allies. And I think it's a matter of being an ally. It's a matter of realizing and looking and seeing where the injustice is and not thinking your neighbor is going to take care of that injustice, but in somehow getting involved. And that getting involved can be writing letters to elected officials. That getting involved can be finding out about the local trans community and where their needs are. You know, and just getting involved and not assuming that someone else is going to take care of it and knowing where there's injustice and voting, you know, let's, you know, if there's discriminatory acts that are going on, I mean, for God's sakes, all men and women are created equal. Let's live by that adage.
I recall from interviewing several different trans activists on my program that there is a bit of a turbulent or uneven history, shall we say, in terms of to what extent the overall gay community and gay activists welcomed the participation or presence of those who were trans, that they were not necessarily always seen as kind of part of the same fabric, but maybe as more distinct communities. Do you happen to recall that? And do you see a closer and more seamless community now?
I certainly think that that's the case. I think that when the when the gay rights movement started, it did not necessarily embrace and bring in the trans community, and the trans community itself was at that stage in a different place in its own evolution, trying to figure its own way through. But nonetheless, it was not brought in. And in some ways, the gay rights movement as well didn't bring in oftentimes communities of color as they should have in some ways. And so I do believe that that is the case. And I think that it's important of a debt that we owe to lean in to our trans brothers and sisters and help them today. You know, I won't judge the hows and the whys. I will just look at history says it's so. And if it is so, then we have an obligation to try to right potentially a wrong.
For those who care about this issue and particularly who appreciate the work of the National AIDS Memorial, what would be some of the best ways that they could support your work?
Well, of course, we're a not-for-profit. We, since our inception, have foregone public funding, so we don't take government funding. So we, of course, are always open to financial support and contributions. We will, as I said, also be taking the quilt back out on the road, coming into this World AIDS Day, and so volunteerism. So you can learn more about either how to volunteer or to display the quilt in your own community, or make a donation to the National AIDS Memorial, which supports the quilt as well, at aidsmemorial.org. You know, but I guess I would say whether you give directly to us, support your own community. Get involved in making a difference in your own community. That's the legacy that we all have the obligation to leave to those that follow. You know, at the end of the day, as I have the opportunity to spend a lot of time with young people in the memorial who are, come out on alternative spring breaks and the like, and I say, you know, I encourage you to get the best grades and get a great job that pays great money and make a lot of money. But at the end of the day, all the money in the world isn't going to make you happy inside. What makes you happy inside is when you give back to another human being, and it's one human helping another. And you know that at the end of the day, you're improving the fabric of the community you live in. That's what we as a gay community have done for so long, trying to improve our own community and thus the community of those around us. So I just say, get involved, see where there's injustice, right the injustice. There's much work to be done now. There's a lot going on in our country that is really scary. And so, don't stand on the sideline. Don't get discouraged. What does Nancy say? Don't commiserate, activate, or something like that.
And for sure, do not be complacent.
Exactly. Get involved.
Absolutely. I wanted to mention, by the way, the book that I was trying to remember is How to Survive a Plague, The Inside Story of How Citizens and Science Tamed AIDS by David France, a really, really interesting book. And remind our listeners one more time of the address, that is the web address of the National AIDS Memorial.
It's the National AIDS Memorial, and you can find us at AIDS Memorial, AIDSMEMORIAL at O-R-G, AIDSMemorial.org.
John Cunningham, Chief Executive of the National AIDS Memorial, thank you so much. Thank you for being part of the morning show. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a very intriguing book by J.B. McKinnon, who has written extensively on a number of different issues related to the world around us. The book that he has most recently written is called The Day the World Stops Shopping: How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. He is calling into question the assumption that is widely made that consumerism is a good thing, and that the more we consume, the healthier our economy is and our overall well-being. He believes, in fact, consumerism is misunderstood and is happening to an extent that is damaging our world and ourselves. A really intriguing book, and we talk about it tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Friday, Kristen Cantino. And she talks about her latest book, which is a novel called The House Full of Windsor. It is an intriguing story of a mother and daughter, and the mother is a hoarder. And there are intriguing reasons why she is hoarding the things she is, specifically memorabilia related to the British royal family, and especially Princess Diana and Prince Charles. And it's a book that helps all of us think a lot about what might be behind this kind of phenomenon. And over the weekend, in the podcast version of The Morning Show, a recording from many, many years ago with Kurt Schalgren and three of the students involved in